As an arts organization, we care more about the artistic integrity. In many cases, an artwork in preservation will, for the first time, do everything that the artist actually wanted it to do. So because then there is time to capture all the data or to bring together different versions that existed at different points in time and make it into one whole thing. We also keep different versions of the same artwork, sometimes preserved with using different conservation techniques. There's never a canonical version of any of these works.
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matuszek, and today's guest is Dragan Estmeshit. Dragan is the director of Rhizome's Digital Preservation Program. If you haven't heard about Rhizome, it's one of the most important and longest-running organizations dedicated to commissioning, exhibiting, and preserving digital art. Based in New York since 1996, their vast archive at rhizome.org has become an invaluable resource. Back here in Europe, Dragan and I met in a Zoom call to talk about his life and work. With his background as an artist and musician that experiments with digital tools, we talked about the challenges of preserving digital art over time and archiving as an act of resistance against the dominant power structures in our digital world today. Welcome to the podcast, Dragan. Very happy to have you here. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, so I'm Dragan Estmeshit. I'm the preservation director at Rhizome, which is a digital art non-profit organization that's located on the internet and has headquarter offices in New York City.
A lot of your research over the last few years or decades even is about something called digital folklore. And I'm curious about the term, what it means and what kind of work you have been doing in that field.
So digital folklore originally is a book that pioneer net artist Olya Yalina and myself published as editors in 2009. And it was an attempt to write a different type of history of digital culture and computers and networks, focusing on what users have done, what users have contributed. It's also very much focused on the time, and it defines this term digital folklore as the things that users came up with during the 1990s, maybe up until 2010. And users in this case is defined in kind of an opposition to the tech industry, to the computer industry, to internet corporations, great inventors. When we talk about this history, we almost always focus on the great man that brought the Apple computer to the world, but we don't really talk so much about the web. This huge explosion of user culture happened. So a lot of it had been ridiculed at the time. It was kind of an economic necessity to get rid of it so that the web could be thoroughly industrialized.
I'm curious, I think what you mentioned already is sort of like the evolution of the web from what it was in the 90s to what it is today. You mentioned the industrialization of the web. And I thought digital folklore, even though you published the book in 2009, and I think you did a re-edition in 2019, so 10 years later, I still think it's such an important concept because I think technology and the internet is more and more dominated by industrialized players and monopolies or oligarchies in a way that pretty much define the entire experience of what it means to be on the internet nowadays. So I thought focusing on the user experience and the contribution of users and what people do actually with these tools is a very important practice to tell an alternative history of what the internet actually is and what it means to people and to the world and to society at large. So when it comes to these terms, what do you think about the evolution of the last 10 years, maybe, since you published the book? What has changed?
With the appearance of very powerful platforms that you also mentioned that talk a lot about optimizing the user experience and making everything easier, it is a huge de-skilling of the folks that are using the internet. It is not harder today than it was 30 years ago. In fact, it's much easier. to, I don't know, publish a web page or create a podcast, to do what you want online, but no one knows anymore how to do it because the platforms are dominating. And that has kind of brought us in a kind of sad situation where anything that happens culturally online is always in relation to the tech industry. And you can also see this happening in digital art, of course. So there's like a huge loss of autonomy of what users could do. But I also don't want to glorify the past and say, oh yeah, the 90s with the funny web pages where there was MIDI music playing in the background and funny GIFs were glittering and moving from left to right and everything looked a little bit more folksy. It was very much like that. The foundations for what we have now were laid back in that day. So for instance, GeoCities, which is a project that Olya and I also have been focusing on a lot. It was, at its time, it was like a comparable platform to what we have today. It is just that users had to do much more work to get their things online, and there was much more friction. And that was, yeah, the environment in which a new culture could appear. If you think that if all the bandwidth in the world and all the screen resolution and whatever we have today would have been available back then, the web would have already been like TV. It's moving very close to what TV used to be right now as well.
Speaking about culture, what you just mentioned, you know, you don't want to glorify the old days. And I think it's interesting for you, for someone like you to say that, because you obviously have been part of this early net culture. You now introduce yourself as the preservation director at Rhizome, but I think you also have this history as a musician and as an artist, very much using these tools that were available at the time in the 90s to create something out of it. And there was a certain scene, a certain community, a certain culture being built around that, that's still alive today in some way. But how would you compare that, without glorifying the old days, to what we have today, where obviously so many more people are online and creating things online because it's much more accessible, it's much faster, it's much easier to create stuff. How did it change the internet culture and digital culture that we have today compared to when you were participating or innovating in the early 90s?
Looking back, I would say that, of course, the landscape was more open and there were much more niches you could fill. And yeah, I was mainly part of online communities that were concerned with music and music creation, music exchange, knowledge sharing about how to make music, organizing events and all these kinds of things. Since no platforms existed at that point in time, every community kind of had to come up with their own way, how they want to do things. And today it's more about like which of the five available solutions that already exist am I going to pick? And in many cases, this is like concentrating into monopolies. Like you would say, okay, where do I publish my photos? Of course, I publish them on Instagram. Where do I publish my music? Okay, I need to get on Spotify, but yeah, I could also use SoundCloud or something like that. But these platforms try to appear as something that is very transparent and that push you straight to the content. For instance, when you look at Instagram or something like that, you almost don't notice that it's designed at all. It appears like it is getting you straight to the quote content unquote. But just how do you get to it and in what order things are presented to you? And exactly by this minimalism, it absolutely controls what is happening. And of course, everyone is directed into some activities that will benefit these platforms mostly. And that is something that was not necessarily the case in that time, because also I think the companies were not as powerful as today, of course. Many of them hadn't yet figured out how to do these things, how to really direct what users should be doing. So exactly how these things happen, how you get to, let's say, a certain image, how you are able to connect with someone else, how do you get to hear that audio file, let's say, this is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. This is what defines communities.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So what you say is what actually defines communities or maybe also culture in some way is not so much the thing itself, let's say the music, the song, the artwork or something, but the how it gets to people, how it's being uploaded, where it's being shared. And these processes are much more normatized nowadays and also controlled and maybe optimized for making profit for platforms that actually leaves very little freedom to create something surprising maybe or outside the box. Would you agree with that?
Any community or any person that wants to express themselves online will always be will always have to relate themselves to the technology corporations, to internet corporations. The platforms are advanced in a way right now that you are unable to criticize a platform or have a different view on a platform, because the only thing that you can express yourself is that platform. When anything that users are contributing online, since it has become content, that also means that the platforms have the power to present it in different ways and to shift it around and to present you something old is new and say, oh yeah, we don't show the date on this because that's better for mental well-being or something like that, so that you don't have such a lot of information on screen. But yeah, you cannot even formally shape your expression or let's say your art so that it does something with the platform, because the platform can change tomorrow. Your content will still be there and it will stop making sense if you engage with the platform itself as a topic, so to say. So if you do that, your content, which is a horrible word, will have a very short shelf life.
This is now, I think, the perfect segue to go into your work at Rhizome, and we work with preserving digital art and archiving things. So how does what we just discussed, the dynamics of the internet as it works today, how does it influence your work at Rhizome? Like, how does it influence the way you archive digital art? Exactly, given that if the platform changes, the art disappears. How do you deal with that?
In the tradition of media art or new media art, artworks in the end were very much like performances. So let's say you would install some impressive virtual reality thing at Ars Electronica or whatever, and it would be there for a few days, and a bunch of technicians would make sure that it works during that time. But then when the exhibition is over, it's torn down, and the next time it's built up again, usually from scratch, because you might not be able to get the exact same parts, or you use that computer for something else that you used last time already, or that computer broke, or I don't know, you can't put the CD anymore in the CD drive because there is no CD drive, the usual stuff. So that was very much like restaging your opera over and over. And the audience online has another expectation of how things work. So it means like you go somewhere, you type in a URL in your browser and you are expecting to see that artwork. And that means it has to be there all the time. That is a big difference that I want to start out with when you think about art online versus like other types of digital art even. Since the data itself, or like the, let's call them files or whatever, these things, they don't degrade. They are there for eternity. I mean, you can store them somewhere, and if you think that, oh, that storage is not good, you copy it to some other storage and it will still be there. It will be exactly in the state as you want it to. What changes is the environment that you want to perform this thing in, this software. So in the end, I regard everything as software that I'm dealing with. And I don't think about images. I think an image is a software that requires another software, so that from some gobbledygook on your computer, you will see colorful pixels on some display. The focus that I've been putting on since working for Rhizome since 2014 is not to go to the data, go to the artwork and fix it and change it so that it works in the new environment, but to preserve the environments. So for instance, for classic net art, at Rhizome, we have a bunch of prepared environments, like a Windows 98 system that runs in an emulator, that features a Netscape browser with a Flash plugin and a Real Audio plugin or something like that. Then you place the artwork inside that environment. You place the artwork data in that environment and it works again in most cases. I mean, this is of course very simplified, and in many cases you, of course, cannot work on this ideal level and never change the artwork at all. But that's a big conceptual shift that you need to do for online art.
Just curious, it means at Rhizome, which is a group of people, an organization with also a physical location in New York, do you have room with all kinds of computers and systems running on it and a server? And this is where all of this is stored and preserved? Like, how can we visualize what you just told us?
Rhizome has offices in New York and is affiliated with the New Museum in New York, where in-person events happen a lot. But the office is not even staffed every day of the week, I would say. And we don't have any hardware apart from everyone's laptop. So everything is like located on cloud computing services, because also, yeah, not everyone that works for Rhizome is even present in New York. One of the first things that I did when starting out at Rhizome is that there was a bunch of old Macintosh computers and a scanner and a few screens and so forth. And I put out a message on social media. We have a bunch of equipment to give away. Whoever wants to have it can take it, because to actually keep hardware accessible or useful in a useful state, that's a lot of effort. And I decided Rhizome will not focus on that. We will completely focus on software. We are an online organization. We need to put things online, and you can't put an old Mac computer that is under your desk. You can't put it on the internet for others to interact with. And if it would be possible, it would be only one computer. So if three people want to see an artwork at the same time, it wouldn't be possible.
So that's basically what you meant with you only care or regard everything as software, as in non-physical embodied lines of code, essentially, that live in a cloud, and you create these emulators. I think I also saw that there's this tool that you called emulation as a service. So basically anyone can download an emulator of Windows 98 to their computer in the future and is able to look at that media art or net art that you've archived through that emulator. That's the concept you developed, right?
Yes, so emulation as a service is it was originally a research project that came out of the University of Freiburg in South Germany. It is executing these emulators on public cloud computers and is streaming the output of that computer, which is a video screen. It's like you're having a Zoom call with some old computer, basically. Your mouse movements and keyboard inputs and anything will go over the network to that remote emulator. So users don't have to install anything, because also installing anything today has become so difficult that you can't ask people to do that. Anything that's outside of an app store or something like that can be regarded as inaccessible to most folks, I guess.
How would you explain the role and mission of Rhizome in the longer term? Is Rhizome a museum in some way that collects and preserves media art and makes it accessible to the public?
I think very much what you said, yes. So Rhizome was founded in 1996 as a mailing list at that point in time by artists who were working in the new media and digital art field and kind of wanted to have an organization that represents them so that their art is taken seriously, that it's regarded as real art, that it's like worthy of criticism and worthy of reflection, and that it's not just some technical gimmick. One of the earliest impulses of Rhizome was actually preservation. In 1999, Rhizome already opened the Artbase, which is the name for this archive. In the beginning, everyone who was a Rhizome community member and felt that they are a digital artist, they could just upload their art there, or they could paste the link there and say, now I'm a digital artist, I'm part of Rhizome's art base. There were very few hurdles to get into that archive. So that is where also a lot of the back catalog of Rhizome is coming from. And of course, I mean, this type of accession also has its downsides. So today Rhizome is a very much curatorially led institution that is commissioning and presenting and reflecting on art online and digital art in general.
I'm also curious, how did you personally get into archiving and preservation. You got started as a musician and then also developed artwork, got into teaching. But like, where does the fascination or the passion for archiving come from? Like, was there a specific experience, maybe a specific moment where you thought, this is important, I want to get deeper into that field?
I don't think there is a specific moment, but I mean, the whole history that I have behind me is, as a musician in the middle of the 90s, I had this band with my friend Bernhard Kirsch, which was called Bodenständig 2000. And we already used legacy equipment at that point in time. So we were using computers from the 80s, or really low-tech stuff that you could get on eBay super cheap at that point in time. Then found out about many other folks that did the same thing. We were part of this micro music platform. And so at that point in time, I felt like these things are exchanged so fast and we haven't even seen what can be done with them. I took these old computers very seriously as instruments and as systems, and I wanted to become good at playing an instrument, so to say. And when doing these NetArt projects with Ulja Ljalina, Ulja was very much into this user culture thing and still is today, absolutely more than I would say. And there were so many like really unjust stories of how these things were wiped out, of how these things were just deleted because you couldn't make money off of them, or the data wasn't in the right structure so that it could be analyzed for understanding what commercial banner you need to put on top of it or something like that. So I thought that's all just pretty weird and ahistorical, and it makes it impossible for users and for anyone actually to learn from the past. That's very difficult. And I think then one really interesting event was in 2011, I visited the App Art exhibition at ZKM.
The museum.
Mm-hmm. One of the leading art museums in the world. They had this program called App Art, and it was presenting artistic apps for iPhones and iPads. And I thought, this is like 90s CD-ROMs art, but in a higher resolution. So where can I compare this? What is the trajectory of this type of art? It was like, you know, really simple stuff, like, or sometimes also games. Certain screens were presented to you. You could interact on a touch screen instead, like moving a mouse pointer around. I understood at that moment that there is absolutely no way this can be discussed, because you can't access this old software anymore. So I was kind of also annoyed by a very repetitive discourse of continuous novelty of, if you're interested in this type of thing for 10 years, it feels repetitive. I wanted to have a better discourse. I wanted to have better art. I wanted to have an advancement of the field instead of the same things over and over in higher resolution.
So would you say in that regard that preservation is a sort of resistance to dominant narratives told by dominant players in the field, act against the mainstream or act for something that a certain group of people finds is important enough to preserve? Just because you mentioned things get deleted so easily, things get wiped out, the user itself has so little power that kind of advocating for the user and the things that users create is maybe some form of resistance. Would you agree with that?
In many instances, it absolutely feels like that. And it feels very hard. You're definitely fighting an uphill battle. And indeed, the basic logic of preservation goes against the tech industry and what the tech industry is interested in. Of course, the tech industry is interested in computer museum in San Francisco, or this was the first packet sent over the internet, but this is again a focus on like the grand inventions and the awesome industrial power of the computer industry. I want to give an example about a platform like Instagram. So Instagram is a platform that is also accessible on the web, and Instagram changes their design whenever they feel like it, and they reorder your images, which makes it very hard to narrate for an artist and so forth. But at some point it was possible. And Rhizome was also part in incubating a web archiving tool called WebRecorder, which is now an independent open source project, and Rhizome runs a web archiving platform that is accessible to everyone called Conifer. And so what is your chance as an artist to like do something using the affordances that Instagram represents to you right now, but you know it might be gone in a month because there is some unscheduled decision to change everything around. But with a web archiving tool, you have a chance to capture, to take a snapshot of how a platform looks right now, how the things that you created look in this very moment. It takes a snapshot of your stuff with the environment around it as well, keeping it interactive. So it's not like a screenshot or a video recording, but you will be able to navigate around and maybe see what structure you built at that point in time and what happens when you scroll and all these things. And that is really like a very positive appropriation, I would say. And the same thing is with an emulator. So you had to update your computer so that you can communicate with other computers on the internet, even like to do such a basic thing, or I don't know, to get the latest emojis and you can communicate with your peers instead of just getting squares, like little squares instead of emojis on your screen. But you can also take a snapshot of an old computer, or maybe of an artist's old computer, let's say, to make a copy of that complete drive and combine it with an emulator. And then you have that point in time preserved and you can start from there. It's an expression of user power, if that's possible.
So both of these tools that you developed, both emulation as a service and web recorder, could be described as not just tools that capture something on a surface level, but actually that capture an entire environment and all its possible interactions within that environment and preserve that almost like a time capsule that you could open in 10 years' time and have the same interaction as at the time when you recorded it.
Yes, that is the idea. Yeah. When you think about these environments, you always have to think that these preservation tools, they regard the environments in their totality in some way, but also it is important to draw a boundary around them so that they can be packaged and handled, and not only on a technical, but also on a conceptual level. So on the web archiving level, you think about the browser. What is the browser doing while you're browsing a website or while you're browsing a social media platform? It sends requests out into the web to maybe 50 different servers that are tracking what you're clicking on, and one server that shows you the image that you want. If you remove all of these unwanted actions, the platform will register that it's broken and it will not work. You record this whole traffic that is happening. And then when you want to revisit that session later, when you want to have the same interaction, the recording of the traffic is there. And a web archiving system then picks out of this recording the data that you need when you click a certain button. So you have like the browser and the rest of the web. And with an emulator, it's a complete computer system, a complete operating system, so that you also don't have to think about what components do I need. I don't need to describe everything in incredible detail and then at some later point in time try to reassemble it. But I view this thing in its totality. I view Windows 98 as like one thing that no one knows exactly how it works. But there is this piece of software that you can place inside and that expects Windows 98 to exactly behave as it used to. And then you can do that. And yeah, the next very interesting step in that direction is to, you know, have several computers in a single session that are acting on an emulated network as well. This is very important for multi-user stuff. And we have already been successful to combine emulators and web archives and, yeah, the first steps in multiple systems on one network are there. It's not at the stage right now where you could say, I just put a bunch of emulated computers in an emulated network and let's go. This still requires a lot of handiwork, but this is where the research is going.
I'm curious, when you compare Rhizome or your work at Rhizome to other archive platforms like the Internet Archive, where basically anyone can go type in the name of a website and find versions of that website from 10 years ago or 20 years ago, etc. I have no idea how it works. I'm always impressed by how is it possible to archive these billions of websites?
Yeah.
But what you do with Rhizome is you obviously can't archive all the output by billions of people on the internet, and you have to make a decision on what is getting preserved and what is not getting preserved, right? So can you tell us a little bit about how these decisions are being made?
Of course, right, as I mentioned before, Rhizome is really a curatorially led institution these days, and there are several programs that develop relationship with artists that look at interesting topics and conversations. And we try to work together on this as a whole organization. If there's an interesting conversation happening in art at a certain moment and you want to revisit that conversation, of course, it makes sense to also have artworks that are discussed or that are relevant for a certain movement so that they can be like accessed later. And yeah, the open accessioning of the Internet Archive, for instance, of course, Rhizome doesn't have the capacity here, but also Rhizome's mission is clearly focused on artworks. And also, I think a big difference also to organizations like the Internet Archive or, I don't know, the UK National Library also has an impressive web archive, or the Portuguese web archive, it's an underrated web archive. For them, it is very much about technical integrity. A website from any of these archives can be like proving court or so. As an arts organization, we care more about the artistic integrity. In many cases, an artwork in preservation will, for the first time, do everything that the artist actually wanted it to do. So because then there is time to capture all the data or to bring together different versions that existed at different points in time and make it into one whole thing. But also, we also keep different versions of the same artwork, sometimes preserved with using different conservation techniques. There's never a canonical version of any of these works.
Basically, the answer to the question is it's a classical approach to curators deciding what they deem important enough to preserve.
Yeah, but I know this approach is challenged in recent times a lot, and saying, oh yeah, these are gatekeepers. There's like an in-group of people that you need to know. This is really from Rhizome's long history. I believe this was more the case in the late 90s when Rhizome just ran an open archive where anyone could upload whatever they wanted with like very little criteria to stop you from doing that. Because that means you need to be on the internet in the 90s. You need to be like technically savvy enough. You need to know how to work a computer, how to make something on the internet. It was all like pretty well off folks from the Northern Hemisphere. But with a curatorial approach, you can actually work towards a more just representation of digital culture, a real equitable representation. If you work without such a mission in mind or such a goal in mind, you will get what everyone else is getting. You will preserve Super Mario and Mortal Kombat, some Instagram influencer. Rhizome tries to think more long-term and also take on things that are maybe falling through the cracks in other places. I don't say Super Mario is bad or Instagram influencers are bad. I think Mortal Kombat is bad though. But but you also have to think like, what can Rhizome actually do? What is different? What service can Rhizome bring to its communities? I mean, the Internet Archive is fantastic, and it has also gazillions of emulators and gazillions of websites that I use in preservation work every day.
My final question would be, when it comes to media art and net art that you are preserving, what kind of artworks or streams are you currently excited about? What do you think is quite relevant that's happening today in that field?
I think personally, and that is not necessarily the things that Rhizome will focus on in its programs, but I have always been, and that probably comes from my involvement with this like folklore thing, I'm always interested in parallel developments and stuff that people do online that kind of doesn't fit in the current discussion. It's artists like setting very clear terms about how you meet their art. So I'm very much interested in that. And I'm also happy that at Rhizome, we think about these things a lot. And for instance, we recently did an accession of Tumblr blogs that used to be like an incredibly important platform for online art, and which, I don't know if you heard the news, was sold to the company that also runs WordPress, which is a good company, but they poured so much money into Tumblr and they didn't make anything back. They're not actually winding it down, but Tumblr will just continue to exist. They will not delete anything, but it's out of the discussion, and at some point something weird will happen. What's also quite interesting is a lot of artists today, they think much more about infrastructure than they used to. They think about a future where all these powerful computing platforms and services are maybe not possible or not ethical to run anymore. And what you can do with just solar powered systems or really low tech small computers or low resolution graphics, things like that.
That was Dragon Asmsheet from Rhizome. If you're interested in learning more about Rhizome's archive and activities, visit rhizome.org. And if you're interested in learning more about preserving and collecting digital art, check out episode 3 of this podcast with curators Natalie Kane and Marlies Wirth. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.